You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing from Brighton and beyond. We've got a jam-packed episode for you today. It's our Christmas special, so we've got recommendations from booksellers from Sissy Books and Daunt Books. We talked to the founder of Afrori Books, which has just opened in Brighton. And I also talked to this month's book club book authors, Michaela Clements and Anjuli Datta, about their wonderful book, The View is Exhausting. Now, you may have noticed over the past couple of months that I've had a bit of help with the show, and that help comes in the form of the wonderful Caitlin Gleeson, who is a bookseller at Sissy Books and has been doing some interviews for me. Now, I asked Caitlin if she would help me out with our Christmas gift guide this year. Caitlin also works at Sissy Books in Hove and has given me a list of the top five fiction and the top five non-fiction, and we're going to go through them as a bit of a Christmas gift guide. And later in the show, I will be joined by Elizabeth Perry from Daunt Books, who's going to be suggesting some alternative reads to these bestsellers. So Caitlin, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you for having me, Anna. It's lovely to be here.
So let's talk about how business has been over this past year, because it has been a strange time to work in retail.
Absolutely, it has. I think the main thing that has been a struggle, or certainly an obstacle for independent bookshops, is just keeping in touch with your customers during lockdown. It was really difficult, but thankfully, being able to do things like click and collect and mail out orders and just having a really loyal customer base dedicated to independent bookshops has made it quite a sustainable experience, certainly for us.
So without further ado, let's crack on with this list, because we've got some really, really interesting books on the bestseller. So number one, not hugely surprised to see Sally Rooney's The World, Where Are You? At the top. Let's talk about this book.
So, I mean, of course, it's Sally Rooney's signature style. It's all about like relationships, sex, and generally slice of life, figuring out who these young people are. Obviously, after the massive success of Normal People, whatever she brought out next was going to be a huge hit. And Beautiful World, Where Are You? Was absolutely no different. We sold 70 copies on the first day. We absolutely cleaned out. We had people coming in for pre-orders well in advance of the book coming out. And I think everything that people have said has said that it's been just as gritty and drama filled and kind of sexy and raw as Normal People. And so that's why we've seen success off the back of that. It's exactly what people wanted from Rooney, and that's what she gave them.
Amazing. Okay, right. So moving on to our number two, Piranesi by Susanna Clarke, which we have discussed because it was the winner of the Women's Prize. And I'm really glad to see it up here, because I wasn't familiar with Susanna Clarke's work before. Were you?
I wasn't, no. I mean, a few people that I work with really loved Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norell. So Piranesi was not what we expected to win, if I'm honest. But it seems to be the book that people who aren't generally readers come in up to the desk and ask for straight away. They want to read Piranesi, not just because it won the Women's Prize, but because they've had it recommended to them by so many people. And I think it starts off as quite a disorientating beginning of the book, but it's the one that's most often bought as a gift by someone who has read it themselves and really wanted to give it to somebody else. So that, I think, is quite an accolade in itself.
Absolutely, absolutely. It really does feel like a word of mouth sensation.
Absolutely, it was, yeah.
So moving to number three, we've got Kazu Ishiguro's Clara and the Sun. This is one that we've discussed quite a lot on the show as well. What did you make of this?
You know, it's his first book since winning the Nobel Prize in Literature, and I will say, as an independent bookshop, this is one of our most pre-ordered titles months in advance. It sold exceptionally well for a high price point book. It's £20 hardcover, whereas, you know, Sally Rooney, for example, is $16.99. And it also has led to a massive increase in his back catalogue. We are selling Never Let Me Go at least a couple of times a week. So it was one of those ones that people were really excited for, they were really geared up for, and that absolutely translated in sales and interest of people coming into the shop.
The Promise is the next book on the list by Damon Galgut, which has just won the Booker Prize for fiction, if I'm right. This was another author that I was not familiar with before.
Yeah, me too. It was one of those ones that I think, again, none of us in the bookshop expected it to win. It wasn't the front runner. We really expected Patricia Lockwood's book to win. So, of course, anything that won the Booker was always going to be incredibly successful. The day the Booker was announced, we immediately sold out all of our copies before 11 a.m., which is quite something. And it was quite a surprising win, but one that people have really enjoyed and have come back saying that they really loved. And in, you know, in his own words, he was on the Penguin Vintage podcast quite recently, just before he won, actually. And he said of his books that they tend to grow out of constellations of ideas for him rather than of singular ideas. And I think this book represents a very specific idea that he had about family relations and funeral, experiencing life through funerals. So it was quite an unusual win, but I think that's why it won and that's why people liked it, because it was just different.
Harlem Shuffle by Colson Whitehead is an author that I'm familiar with, as many people are, and I'm really happy to see this on in the top five bestsellers.
Yeah, I mean, people were excited about this one. I mean, everybody's excited about new releases, but everyone who came up to the counter with a copy of Harlem Shuffle also said to us, anybody working, you know, have you read The Underground Railroad, which is what you'd expect from someone who's won a Pulitzer Prize twice. It's, you know, it's part crime, part family saga, mainly revolving around race and power in 1960s New York. And people just love Colson Whitehead. They find something really valuable in his books, obviously. And it's one of the ones that, even if you weren't particularly into him before, I think people were coming in, as you say, word of mouth, people saying, if you haven't read The Underground Railroad, you have to read his new one, Harlem Shuffle. And that's why it was one of the top sellers for us, definitely.
So a bit of Colson Whitehead's back catalogue might be a really good gift for someone this Christmas.
Absolutely. Underground Railroad or Nickel Boys would be a fantastic place to start.
Amazing. Right, let's move on to our nonfiction. So number one, relatively unsurprisingly, just because of the nature of the author, Paul McCartney's lyrics. This sold really well, right?
It did. And it's an expensive book, but it's expensive because it's big. There's a lot of stuff in it. It's full of images, personal archives, letters, photos, paintings, all previously unseen items. McCartney's quite personal, and so this has given people who are fans of him a really significant insight into the making of his music and his life. So it's not surprising that this one would be up there. And coming up to Christmas, it's an expensive gift, but it's a really sentimental, beautiful gift, which is why it's doing quite well.
Absolutely. It's funny, isn't it, how the higher priced products can often be the ones that sell the most.
Yeah, and I think it represents to a lot of people, I think, just the special meaning behind it. You know, you have this very, some people might take it as a coffee book, some people take it as a keepsake, but however you give it, I think it's a very significant, beautiful gift.
Dave Grohl, another musician.
Yeah. So top two being taken up by music is not surprising, but it is really nice. Dave Grohl, even if I think people didn't know who Dave Grohl was initially, they were really interested to read his biography. It's the first one he's written. He also is quite private. So his biography really charts his life. And even people who aren't super fans really wanted to see what he had to say. They really wanted to know more about him. And he's a funny guy. It's a funny book. It is really touching and heartfelt and just really interesting to have his perspective on things like Nirvana and Foo Fighters and his whole career.
Yeah, I guess this could be a gift for maybe a slightly younger music lover than Paul McCartney.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're seeing in every aspect of our lives a very much a resurgence of early 2000s culture at the moment, which makes me feel incredibly old. But it's one of those things that people now, you know, younger kids who are 16, 17 are getting back into Nirvana and discovering it for the first time. So this is the kind of thing that would really, I think, be quite fun for them to read.
Dave Grohl also does seem like the nicest man in...
He does. He's kind of this very wholesome looking guy, and it translates in his book, I think, which is why it's just done so well.
Oh, good. I'm so happy. So Bernadine Evaristo won the Women's Prize with her novel Girl, Women, Other last year. And she's also the author of many books, including one of my favourites called Mr. Loverman. Manifesto is a non-fiction by Bernadine Evaristo. I'm really, really happy to see this on this list. What's the kind of feedback you've been getting from it?
The feedback that we get from it is that people are just so delighted to have an insight into her thought process. Because as you say, she's done fiction and her fiction sells so well. We still sell 2 to 3 copies of Girl, Woman, Other every week. So it's been such a fantastic opportunity for people to get an insight into her thought process, her feelings about, you know, race and power. And it, people just adore Bernardine Evaristo and they want to know more about her. So it was one of the ones that, again, people walked in, didn't bother browsing. They just asked if we had it and they bought it because they were so delighted to get their hands on it.
And this is one really good gift for any kind of feminist family you have.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think also anyone searching for inspiration as a writer as well. I think it's, you know, hearing her thought process and hearing how she cultivates her stories could be really useful for any budding writer that you have in your life or anyone who's looking for any kind of creative inspiration.
Oh, that is so great to know. Right. Number four is Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. Tell me about this one.
This is such a wild card. We had enormous success with this book this year, and it's not a new book. I believe it's from 2017, 2018. I think because of lockdown and people spending a lot of time at home, a lot of introspection, this book again got around with word of mouth and became popular again, simply because people wanted to understand more about how their inner thought process affected their bodies. And so it's, people buy this two or three copies at a time to give to their family and friends. So I can, you know, that's been reflected in people purchasing for Christmas already. But I think the reason it was so successful is because there is this newly ignited interest in understanding the mind-body connection in a renewed sense.
That sounds absolutely fascinating and definitely a bit of a wild card. It's always nice to see something unexpected on these lists, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, so last but not least, One by Anna Jones. The kind of ethos behind this book is one pot, one pan, one planet. So it's very much kind of in vogue at the moment. Anna Jones is very, very stylish chef. I've got one of her books and I love it and I do go back to it often. So it's nice to see a cookery book on this list.
Absolutely. People, first of all, Modern Cook's Year was hugely successful and still is. It's a very well-rounded book, just like One. And the aesthetic of it, first of all, appeals to people. It's the kind of cookbook that people purchase for, especially with the one pot, one pan. It was a big one around uni students wanting to minimize their washing up and their ingredients list. So, and especially you've got young uni students who really care about the environment and really care about what they put into their bodies and into the, you know, the world at large. So One did exceptionally well when it came out a few months ago and has continued to sell really well for us, just based upon the fact that they're good recipes. It's a good book to give. It's a good book to have. And it really reflects how people feel about the environment and themselves at the moment.
Thank you so much. That is such a good insight. And Caitlin, I would love to know what book you really are hoping to get for Christmas this year.
Oh, what would I love to get for Christmas this year? To be honest, I love cookbooks. If somebody gave me a cookbook, no matter the cuisine, I would be absolutely delighted to have a cookbook. Anything by Sabrina Gaihur, who does Simply, would be fantastic. So if anyone wants to get me that, I'd be very happy. But I think also I've read not a lot of the Booker shortlist, so I'd really like to get my hands on some of that, particularly Patricia Lockwood's No One Is Talking About This, I think would be number one on my fiction read.
And what are you going to be buying for people this year?
My favourite book of the year that I would love to give to people is a book by an author called Zena Arafat, and it's called You Exist Too Much, and it details the life of a queer Palestinian-American woman who is struggling with her identity, is struggling to confront really uncomfortable truths about her family and about her backstory. And it's fantastically, you know, travels through Lebanon to Italy to modern-day America, charting her struggle to find herself and find meaning in her relationships. It was my absolute favorite book of this year, and I will definitely be giving it as gifts this year for Christmas.
Wonderful. Caitlin, if people want to order from City Books, how far do you deliver, and when's the last date that they need to order before to get it in time for the 25th of December?
Absolutely. So I will say this year things are taking slightly longer just with the pandemic. There's a few shortages. So if you'd like to do Christmas ordering, definitely start thinking about it now. The last day I would say it would be like, you know, to absolutely have it in your hands would be 20th of December. And if you want to order a book, you can call us, email us, Instagram, Twitter. We're basically everywhere. And also just pop into the shop and say hello. And if you're looking for inspiration, we're always happy to help. We've always got recommendations. And we, between everybody that works in the shop, we've got a very wide range of readers. So I think we'll have just about everybody covered.
It has become a bit of a tradition on the Brighton Book Club to invite my friend Elizabeth Perry onto the show to give her wonderful Christmas recommendations. And I'm really excited, particularly about this show. And it all feels a bit serendipitous because Elizabeth used to work at City Books in Hove and now works at Dawn in Oxford. So what I have done is shared Caitlin's list of the 10 City Books bestsellers. And I'm going to ask Elizabeth what her kind of slightly alternative, perhaps the books that you might not have seen about that don't have the big budgets behind them that are published by smaller publishers that she would recommend as opposed to the bestsellers or to even complement the bestsellers. So Elizabeth, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much for having me back on.
It's lovely to have you here. So before we start, what have you got in the window at the moment?
We've got all sorts. We've got lots of things that I think you'll be seeing in lots of other places, like the Bob Mortimer book and the Billy Connolly book and some really big, beautiful hardback books like Accidentally Wes Anderson is in there again because everyone is seeing The French Dispatch and enjoying it very much like I did. And then in the kids window, we've got some of my favourite books from this year, like The Upper World by Femi Fadugba and the book I'm reading at the moment, which is Stay Another Day by Juno Dawson. I'm actually on my second read of it because I enjoyed it so much. So yeah, there's lots of good stuff.
Juno Dawson, who is based in Sussex, no less.
Exactly, yes.
So shall we crack on with this list then? Let's go through them in order. So Beautiful World, Where Are You by Sally Rooney was City Books' number one fiction bestseller. If you like this book, what else would you like? What would you suggest?
So the one I'm suggesting for this is one that I know you liked as well, which is Open Water by Caleb Azuma Nelson. It is the most beautiful novel, and I think particularly if you've liked Sally Rooney's books across the board, there's a lot that you'll like here about relationships, but also just most beautiful writing, really engaging characters, but you can't put down. Yeah, I can't recommend it enough, really.
It is stunning. And I read it in paper and I listened to the audiobook. And
oh, wow.
I really recommend doing both because it's almost novella size. It's short, but it really packs a punch. This writing is unbelievable.
Absolutely. There's not a word wasted. It's just, yeah, phenomenal.
Great. Okay. Piranesi by Susanna Clarke.
For this one, I'm recommending a book that I read very recently and absolutely blew me away. And that is Luck and Booth by Jenny Fagan. It is so brilliant and really quite hard to describe. So I think that might be why it's quite a good fit for Piranesi. All takes place in this one tenement building in Edinburgh over, I think it's about 100 years. And right at the beginning of the book, the devil's daughter puts a curse on the landlord and the tenants of the building. And so it's the impact of the curse over these years. But it's beautiful and strange and ferocious and just loved it. It really blew me away. I think it might be my book of the year, maybe. So yeah, highly recommend that one.
That sounds amazing. And
yeah, it's really good.
You answered my question for later, so you'll have to think of another one quick.
Oh no, that won't be hard. I've got like 5 books of the year, realistically. So,
how about Clara and the Sun? You must have seen many and sold many Ishiguro titles in your time.
Yeah, we have. For this one, I guess I was thinking kind of along the lines of more speculative fiction. There's the book I really love called The Dreamers by Karen Thompson Walker, which is quite a tricky book to recommend right now because it's essentially about a pandemic, but it is a very fictional one, something that's making people fall asleep and they're not waking up and the town is essentially quarantined, but it's got a really dreamy, beautiful writing to it as well. So I thought that was quite a good fit for that one. I know that a lot of people are not into reading about this sort of thing at the moment, and that is fair enough, if you're not into the pandemic content, that, you know, there's other things that you can read. But it is a really beautiful book, so one I recommend you remember for the future if you want a bit of distance from right now.
That's very thoughtful of you. So how about The Promise, the Man Booker winner by Damon Gagut?
So this one's a bit of a cheat because I'm going to use it to talk about a book that I really loved that I was so convinced would make it onto at least the Booker long list that I keep forgetting it didn't. And that's This One Sky Day by Leonie Ross, which is this stunning, big, epic, sprawling, magical realism, gorgeous book. And I just, when I read it, it just seemed to have like masterpiece written all over it. And it got to the point where I'd be putting together the books that are on the long list and I'd have This One Sky Day there. And I was thinking, I've got too many books. Like, what have I done here? And then I would realise, oh, it wasn't actually there. I don't know why this isn't something that's happened to me before. Like, I don't really do prize predictions or anything because I'm terrible at it. But there was just something about that book that seems... yeah, phenomenal. I know I've said that already about something else, but it really deserves that word. It's stunning and unlike anything else I've read. So if you wanted something that was a real kind of literary heavyweight, that is one I definitely recommend.
Amazing. Well, I'm sold. I'm always sold. You know, this is a very expensive show for me. Okay, last but not least on the fiction list, Harlem Shuffle by Colson Whitehead.
Yeah, so this is one I haven't read and I really want to read it. I absolutely love the sound of it. And I was thinking along the lines of, I guess, kind of literary crime. And one book that I've read this year that I think fits that description is Intimacies by Katie Kitamura. And it's another one that's quite hard to describe. I think one way I described it was like a sort of Rachel Cusk crime novel. So it's about a woman who's working as a translator in courts where they prosecute things like war crimes. And it's about her experiences there, but also the things that are going on in her life around it. So a relationship she's starting and things like that. Yes, a sort of literary alternative to a standard crime novel. That sounds bad because I love standard crime novels, but something that's like a little bit different, basically, I would recommend that one.
I think that like cross, the word cross genre in publishing is so like in publishing the kind of end that I am rather than bookselling is like a negative thing so often because people can't place things. But I love it when something crosses with something, you know, literary crime or like domestic thriller. Like, I think it's just exciting.
Definitely. Like, I want to be surprised a lot of the time when I'm reading, and something that's bringing a lot of different tropes together or genres together, that's surprising and exciting. So yeah, that's a good thing.
Absolutely. Okay, cool. Let's move on to Lyrics by Paul McCartney.
This was a tricky one because obviously this is a great big £75 gorgeous coffee table kind of book. So I was thinking along the lines of other things for music fans that are like that. There is another Beatles book that is called Get Back, I think. And then there's one of Radiohead artwork that Tom York and Stanley Donwood have done. The one that I personally would be recommending is the Dolly Parton book Songteller, which is gorgeous. And I got that for Christmas last year. And yeah, I can really recommend it. It's beautiful, it's huge, it's full of photos, it's got lyrics, it's got her lovely warm voice all the way through it. Yeah, it's a real like indulgent treat for a fan, I think.
If anyone is listening to this who knows me, thank you very much. Do you have similar thoughts to Dave Grohl's book Storytelling?
Well, the one I thought of for this is another music memoir called It Takes Blood and Guts by Skin. And Skin was the lead singer of a band called Skunk Anansie. And it's a great read. If you don't know Skin, I definitely think she's someone worth knowing about. And it's a really interesting look at rock music and Britpop from a different perspective. And yeah, it's a really good read. I think if you're interested in music and you don't know Skunk Anansie or you don't know Skin, there's still a lot there to enjoy and learn from. So
fabulous. That's a great recommendation. Okay, number 3 out of 5, Manifesto by prize-winning author Bernardine Evaristo.
Yes. For this one, I am recommending The Breaks by Julieta Singh, which is another memoir and is essentially from the perspective of the author writing to her daughter about things like climate change. And I loved it. It made me think about a lot of things in a way I maybe hadn't before. I really like the idea of using a child's imagination to imagine new futures. And I thought this was quite a good match. It was an interesting thinker with a lot of really valuable things to say. So yes, I would recommend that one.
Fabulous. Caitlin, who came on earlier and was talking about Manifesto, said it was also really good for people who were thinking about writing and ideas for writing.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's very true.
Okay, and this one, which I hear was a bit of a curveball, The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk.
Yes, this one. So I like this book a lot. I think people read it for lots of different reasons. So some people read it because it's been recommended to them. Some people read it because they've seen it on TikTok and they're curious. Some people read it essentially to help themselves. And all of those reasons are quite personal. And I've not really read another book quite like it. So I thought for this one, I'd recommend books that I give that feel kind of nourishing or comforting, because I think The Body Keeps the Score can do that. So examples of that for me, there's a book called Little Weirds by Jenny Slate, the comedian, which is all just short little essays about life and relationships. And I love it. I think it makes a really good present for people. There's another one called Be My Guest by Priya Basil, which is all about food and community. And it's in a beautiful hardback, so it makes a really lovely gift. And then the last one that I use for this sort of thing is Colossus of New York by Colson Whitehead, which is, again, quite short chapters all about different locations in New York. And it just really brings the city to life. And it's a very satisfyingly good bit of writing. And those are all books I give to people when I want to give them something that's a little bit special to me, which I think makes a really good present. So if you're ever stuck buying a book and you're not entirely sure what the person likes, getting them something that's really special to you, I think makes a really beautiful gift. And you don't have to worry too much if you don't know what their reading tastes are like.
That is a very top tip. Okay, last but not least, only cookbook on this list, One by Anna Jones.
For this one, I am recommending Cook As You Are by Ruby Tando, which has kept me fed and sane quite a few times the last few weeks. It's brilliant and has lots of different sections in it. Things like cooking if you're low on energy, different storage tips. So if you're batch cooking, so if you don't have lots of time, or if like me, sometimes you just really don't want to cook in an evening. And you just need to get yourself fed, that sort of thing. It's a really practical, fun approach, I think, to cooking, and is really tasty. I can confirm I've tried quite a few things now and there's some really good recipes in there.
Thank you so much for that. That was such a good roundup and so many good alternative recommendations. What was your favourite book of the year?
Technically Open Water came out this year, right at the beginning. So that's definitely up there. Luck and Booth is definitely up there as well. I also really loved Keeping the House by Teja Jin. And Mrs. Death, that was this year as well, wasn't it, by Selena Godden. It's so hard. I don't think I've got one. I think I could do like a book of the year for each genre. but those are the ones that really stand out to me.
And what's on your list this year?
Harlem Shuffle is on my list this year, if anyone buying me Christmas presents is listening. and there must be loads more. And I know there's loads more because I've got a pile to one side at work. maybe there's a new book about Anthony Bourdain by people that knew and worked with him. So maybe that one.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I hope we speak again on here before next Christmas. But how can we find and follow you and see your recommendations in the meantime?
So you can see my recommendations on Instagram. I'm ec.reads. And I do a now very sporadic newsletter of recommendations called Shelf Improvement. And the details to sign up for that, if you would like to, are on my Instagram account.
Afruri Books has recently opened in Brighton, and I'm really excited to be joined by the founder and owner, Carolyn. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thank you. Can you tell us about the bookshop and how it started?
The bookshop started from frustration. I am the mother of three who are now grown-up children. And as they were grown up, I imported books from around the world so that we could read stories where people actually looked like us. Not just looked like us, but represented us in terms of culture and lifestyle. And then George Floyd was murdered and lots of my friends were calling me and saying, where did you get that book? Where did you get that book? And I was just annoyed that actually 20 years later, nothing had changed. And it was so difficult to get these books. So I thought I'll put together this little collection of 100 books. It'll just be for friends and family. And I'll just start a little online shop sort of thing. It wasn't even shopping. It's, you know, it's a sort of thing. And it blew up from there. Friends told their friends told their friends. And within 3 or 4 weeks, we were sending books to Glasgow and all around the country. And then about 4 months after we started, we were approached by The Lighthouse, who asked us if we'd be interested in opening a physical shop in Brighton. I actually laughed and said, absolutely not. Who opens a bookshop in a pandemic? And I, you know, I don't have great experiences as a Black woman living in Brighton. And so I really felt that Brighton wasn't going to be on board with it. I was wrong. That's fine. Happy to be wrong sometimes. We had tried to get some funding to do shop fitting and open the shop, but that wasn't happening. So we thought, okay, it was in for a penny, in for a pound. So we started a crowdfund. We needed £10,000 in 5 weeks to shop fit and be ready to go. We hit £10,000 in 3.5 weeks, and we closed at 5 weeks on £12,460.
Wow, that is amazing. How have you found the interaction with customers? Brighton is a very, very white place.
Yes, have you noticed? I mean, it's weird. I'll be honest, you know, we're in a bubble, and it's a wonderful bubble to be in, because actually the people who come in the shop want to be in the shop. They want to know about Black authors. They want to diversify their bookshelves. The Black people who come into the shop want to have a safe space, a space where they feel comfortable and feel like they can be themselves and not do code switching and all of that kind of stuff. So it's been amazing. It's you know, we're having just the best conversations in the world. I'm just meeting incredible people, and I genuinely don't say this lightly, but we are changing lives. People's lives are being transformed because the bookshop is here. And I'll give you a really quick example is that we had a mum come in, and she was a white mum with a mixed race daughter. And she was actually quite upset because she was talking about hair and saying how difficult it was for her to manage. She didn't know how to look after her daughter's hair. And I was just like, this is ridiculous. Like, this shouldn't be a thing. And so we have set up a hair workshop, which is happening on the 11th of December. We've got a specialist coming down to run this whole workshop. But we've sold over half the tickets already before they've even gone on sale. And that mum, she comes in now actually every single week because her daughter just loves the space. And when I told her this week that we've definitely got the workshop happening, her daughter, who's 7, was just like, we're going, this is amazing, mummy. Like, and it just, yeah, this stuff is life changing. You can't even begin to understand, you know, what it is to grow up with hair that you have no idea how to look after, and nobody else is telling you, and nobody else goes to school and has hair like you. And you've never seen a book where somebody has hair like you. It's so amazing. We had a little boy come in the other day. He was only like 3. And he walked in and he came over to the children's section and he just stood there and just went, wow, mom. And my heart just was like, oh, this is beautiful. We're seeing the most amazing, amazing moments. And I just feel like the most privileged spectator ever. And just what an honor to be here.
Do you think you underestimated like the emotional impact that it would have on you?
Yeah. Did I know I would cry this often? No, absolutely not. It's very rare that we have a day where I am not choked up by something that someone does. I mean, to be honest, every time, particularly a white child sits on our cushions, we've got these bright red and green cushions in the shop. And every time a white child sits on one of our cushions and is just engrossed in a book, I'm just like, okay, hold it down, Carolyn, it's okay, because it's beautiful and because that child is not gonna look at other black people the way that, you know, the media and all these other narratives are telling them to, because what we're doing is we're saying this is what normal looks like. It's normal to see a black astronaut. It's normal to see a 5-year-old boy in a book chasing a monster. That's normal. Why wouldn't that be normal? And by changing those normalities, we literally change the world, literally.
That's amazing. I'm so, so happy for you. Congratulations. I absolutely cannot wait to come down.
Thanks.
So I'm going to ask you for a couple of Christmas recommendations, if you don't mind, of books that you've got stocked in the shop. Firstly, can you tell our listeners where the shop is?
We are in Kensington Street. And there is a very well-known Japanese food shop on the corner. I don't know, advertising enough.
Magamamas.
It might be called something to do with someone's mama. Yes. Someone's mama's shops on the corner. Yeah, so we're on Kensington Street, which is parallel with Kensington Gardens.
Amazing. Right. So, fiction, what are you recommending this year?
Well, my fiction would be Never Saw Me Coming, which is by Vera Kurlan. And I'm all about covers, okay? I'm shallow. I love a good book cover. The cover says, grade A student, grade A psychopath.
Oh, I'm sold.
Exactly, right? It's a win. Yeah, I mean, I love a good, like, kind of book. And this is, you know, some books are just worth noises. This is one of those. Yeah, definitely a big win. Definitely a big win.
Amazing. And how about nonfiction this year?
Nonfiction, that is really easy. It has to be consumed by, I'm going to say AJA Barber. Apologies for saying her name wrong. It's just great. It's about colonialism. It's about climate change. It's about consumerism. It's the book that you must have on your shelf. It's just, it's amazing. Yeah, this book is so me and so Brighton.
How about for young adults this year?
My young adult, well, I'm going to just, this is definitely a personal favourite. It's our book of the month this month, and I'm a big Marvel fan, so it's Miles Morales' Shockwaves, which is a graphic novel. It's Spider-Man is black. It's an incredible book. I mean, it's Marvel, and I'm a massive Marvel fan, so you have to indulge all of my biases. Not only am I a Marvel fan, but I, you know, hats off, Spider-Man is my favourite superhero, so.
Oh, that's perfect then.
Yeah, they're all, it's all wins for me. It's just so cool. It's so cool. It's really hard to find graphic novels. I mean, if the publishing industry is white dominated, the graphic novel industry is just uber. It's so hard. And so, yeah, it's definitely easily this month our best-selling book. And I think that, you know, for us, part of our mission statement is to support Black authors. And I really believe that when we push things like the Miles Morales book forward, although Justin Reynolds is an American author, when people see that, they think, oh, I could do that, yeah. You know, and it's about that kind of shoulder tapping, just like do as I see kind of way of thinking. So we push these novels because we want to see other young people who are just going, I love art, but I don't want to be Picasso, and going, actually, have you considered illustrations, you know? And just, yeah, we want to see big breakthroughs there.
Then how about for children this year?
Oh, easily my favourite children book. And I think I'm pretty sure we are still the only place in the country where you can buy this book. It's a self-published book. It's the best quality self-published book. I mean, if your listeners could see it, they would love it straight away. It's called The Rainy Day Zoo. It's by Kabina Mensa. And I tell you a really short story is that, you know, it's quite hard to deal directly with authors because when you've got hundreds of books in a shop, you haven't got time to do hundreds of invoices. But he sent me this book and said, hello, would you put my book in your shop? And, you know, I'm getting ready to go, well, maybe, but could you get it through the publishers or could we get it through wholesalers? And then I opened it and I just was like, yes, absolutely, hands down, easily. And it's been one of my biggest delights this month has been contacting him and saying, we've sold out, please send us more. Every customer I've had who's opened this book has bought it. It's stunning. The illustrations are beautiful. The story is so simple. You know, little boy can't go to the zoo because it's raining, so he makes his own zoo indoors. It's a breathtaker. It really is. I'm a big fan of children's books.
Me too, absolutely. Okay, great. So I just want to ask you a couple of genre questions too. So I'm going to ask you for crime and thriller fans, what would you recommend this year? And also historical fiction.
I mean, crime and thriller fans, we're a Brighton shop, we're a Black author Brighton shop. So that has to be Dorothy Coombson. There's no competition. Dorothy is a local author, a Black woman. She's a bestseller. She's incredible. So yeah, so Dorothy Coombson's most recent novel, which is I Know What You've Done, is a massive page turner. The paperback comes out at the end of December. For those people who hate hardbacks, I don't understand why you do, but some people do, and I appreciate that. It has to be Dorothy Coombson. She's the queen of the page turn, and she lives in Brighton.
Yeah. And if you scroll back on the show, wherever you get your podcast, you can listen to our crime episode with the wonderful Dorothy Coombson. Yes. So last but not least, historical fiction.
Historical fiction, a new author, new to me, discovered. So obviously lots of other people go, oh, I know her, is Nicole Glover. And she's got two books. One's called The Conductors and one's called The Undertakers. And it's set in America in slavery times, and they help free slaves and they solve like these murder mysteries kind of at the same time.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And it's just, yeah, it's really, they're just like, again, you're just, they really pull you in.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, for joining us today. How can people follow you guys on social media?
We are on all of the social medias as Afori Books. So Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, come and follow us. And then obviously we have an online shop, aforibooks.co.uk. I've got one more. I want to throw in a sneaky recommendation, which is a children's book called My Skin, Your Skin. And it is a book that is aimed at children. It's aimed at from four upwards. I have sold it to grown adults for themselves because it's a book that facilitates conversations about racism. It is beautifully presented. It just gives really clear points, you know, and just talks about you cannot and you should and puts real value on human beings as human beings. And yeah, it's a must.
Thank you so much. You have made my to-buy list very long this year.
Great.
Our book club book this month is The View Was Exhausting. This is a really, really, really exciting book. And it's written by two people, which is even more interesting to me, Michaela Clemens and Anjali Datta, who are writing partners on the page and in love, which is very, very interesting to me. So what I'm going to do is tell you a bit about the book, tell you what I thought of it, and then bring on the authors of this fabulous novel. So Whitman Wynne Tagore and Leo Milanowski are the greatest love story of our time. International movie star meets the beautiful son of a millionaire. Their kisses write headlines and their fights break the internet. Nobody needs to know it's not real.
Wynne knows that Hollywood demands perfection, especially from a woman of colour. Leo just wants to enjoy life and shift press attention away from his dysfunctional family. Together, they control the narrative. Except this time, on the shores of Saint-Tropez, Leo is hiding a secret that is about to send Wynne's world spinning. Now everyone's dream couple must confront the messy reality of their relationship, just as they're starting to realise that they may actually be falling in love. I'm like so gushy. I absolutely, there's nothing I love more than a romantic comedy, but there's also nothing I love more than like a really complex, nuanced romantic comedy. And just the settings, the characters, everything about this was not your average Hollywood love story. It was a comment on race and class and the toxic nature of celebrity. And I absolutely loved it. It was perfect escapism, especially for this time of year when it's cold and a bit miserable and you just want to curl up and read something completely absorbing. So Michaela and Anjali, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you. That was lovely.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you both to introduce yourselves firstly to our listeners. Michaela, do you want to go first?
Sure. So I'm Michaela. I'm an Australian currently based in Berlin. So I'm very far away from my own sunny shores. And I've been writing for basically my entire life. I think I started when I was 5 with an incredibly derivative fantasy novel that seemed to involve a magical rhinoceros. So hopefully my style has improved a little bit over the years. But yeah, it's been a dream really to publish The View Was Exhausting with Ange as well.
Yeah, I'm Ange. I'm from the UK actually, but also now living in Berlin. I think my writing history is more in the kind of emo poetry area rather than the childhood fantasy novel. But yeah, I've been writing for a really long time, and me and Mick have been writing together, I think, for coming up to 10 years now. Basically, for the whole time we've been together, I think writing has kind of been our shared hobby. And then we actually managed to finish a novel, which is great.
I'm desperate to know about the process of writing this book. Did the idea come from both of you? Physically, how did you write together?
Yeah, I think the idea, I mean, I feel like it came sort of organically between us and the conversations we were having. It started in the summer of 2016, but Ange wrote the first email. So Ange wrote me an email with a scene, which is, you know, with a lot of revisions and a lot of changes, still essentially the first scene of the novel. And that kind of kick-started us. And that was how this particular story got started. But yeah, as Ange said, we've been writing together for a long time. So we started when we first met, which was about 9 years ago now. And at the time we were long distance. I was living in Australia, Ange was in the UK. And we basically kind of developed the hobby on the one hand, because we both really love writing and we like each other's writing. And, you know, it was fun to tell stories. And on the other hand, because if anyone's ever been in a long distance relationship, like you get to a point where just being like, so what did you do today, gets a little bit dull. And it was nice to finally have some new things that we could talk about and new characters and plots and stuff like that. So we've always been in the habit of writing, and the way we do it is really simple. We just trade the story back and forth. So sometimes you'll write 200 words, sometimes you'll write 2000 words, and then you hand it over to the other person.
Often it can be more shambolic than kind of chronologically sending the story back and forth to each other. I think especially with this novel in the Saint-Tropez sections, which for us at the time was such a kind of escapist project of being like, we wish we were on a beach holiday and we wish we were really wealthy and had these kind of like extravagant rich people problems, and also wanted to write this really gripping love story. It was lots of kind of like, then they do go on this date, then they go on this date. And then the kind of progression of the plot was something we kind of had to work in afterwards as well, which involves, I think on a technical side, a lot of spreadsheets with kind of like scene one, what happens here, who's in the scene. And then after we've kind of like done all of our experimentation and escapist writing, I think then we start to sort of streamline it a little bit as well.
Yeah, we're very big on editing, and I think especially because we're two writers, that's really important. Like, because we've been writing together for so long, we already share quite a similar writing voice, but in the editing process, I'll rewrite Ange's scenes, she'll rewrite mine. You know, we go over and over and over each other's writing until you get to a stage where even I sometimes will look at a sentence and have no idea who wrote that sentence, or like whether I wrote the beginning and Ange finished it and things like that. So editing for us is a really important way to like put in that structure and the plot and make sure that it obviously runs smoothly and all the things that every writer does when they're editing. But it's also a way for us to make sure that the voice is really cohesive and that you're not kind of tripped up by the feeling that two people have written this.
That, I mean, I'm completely shocked because I just assumed, so there is a point in the novel, so it's kind of a book in three parts, and the second part, the voice changes to Leo's voice, and I just thought, my natural thinking was, right, surely someone wrote the beginning, someone else wrote the middle, then maybe they collabed a bit at the end or something like that, but literally words were written together throughout.
Yeah, we both wrote every single scene, basically. For the final product, both of our voices are in every sentence.
Yeah, I mean, I would think in every single comma, there has been some kind of discussion between us about whether or not that comma should be there. And sometimes it's a polite discussion, and sometimes it's a heated discussion.
Was it really important for both of you to write a not your average kind of love story? There's so much nuance to the viewer's exhausting, and it's political.
I think it's an interesting question because my kind of gut instinct answer is no, not in the sense that we kind of at the beginning of writing this novel were like, it needs to be political and it needs to have a really like strong message and it needs to be saying something really important. I think our kind of initially going into it was like, we really like rom-coms, we love fake dating tropes, we also love rom-coms where it's about two best friends who fall in love because it's just the best kind of sexual tension. And then these two characters that we came up with, Leo and Wynn, really sort of just wandered into our heads, I think, almost fully formed. We knew what we wanted them to look like. I have a British Indian background, so I think we were quite interested in writing a character with a similar background. But I think in terms of the politics that play out through the novel, that was definitely something that sort of was developed as we were writing the plot. And I think especially it's such a central thing that the reason this fake dating relationship is so important to Wynn is because Leo is white. And I think the fact that she's dating this white man makes her so much more palatable to white audiences and really gives her kind of an invitation card into lots of groups and industries that she maybe would have found it harder to get into, and makes it easier for people to imagine her as a kind of like leading romantic lady. And I think that was something that really kind of came out as we were writing the plot and really thinking about what is her day-to-day life like and what sort of problems is she dealing with, what sort of producers is she meeting, what sort of meetings is she getting into. So I think it was actually something that happened quite organically, I would say, if you agree.
Yeah, I think it definitely wasn't a decision, and it was again one of those things where as you write and rewrite and edit, it became more and more important. And yeah, you know, you kind of, a lot of rewriting is asking the question like, okay, why has the character reacted like that? And so with Wynn, it was really important to see how her circumstances shaped her and also how her identity, you know, means that people react to her in certain ways.
But to be honest, also with Leo, I think with Leo, in exactly the same way as we were editing, we kind of had to be like, how has the way he's grown up, the way people see him, the fact that he's a white man, how does that affect his character and how does that affect his decision-making and the way that he views the world and what he thinks is right and what he thinks is the right time to act and all of these different things. I think as a writer, you can't really divorce a character's kind of motivations and personality from their identity. And so in that sense, it was kind of, I don't know, instinctive, I guess.
Yeah.
There's a huge role in this book is Wynn's publicist, because basically the kind of concept of the book is creating a life that looks like is their life, right? And so much of that is basically PR. And there was me being like quite ignorant, thinking surely this doesn't actually happen, but it must do. Did you speak to PR people in the kind of A-list celebrity world to get this insight?
Never spoke to somebody, no. We did a lot of daydreaming, basically. And we felt like we've been doing a crash course in what makes a celebrity function throughout our entire lives just by being very interested in celebrities and just by watching these kind of big pop culture stories spread across the screen, you know, or across our Twitter screen. So while we didn't speak to any publicists, we were very much interested in kind of delving into what does this kind of construction story look like on the inside?
And also, I think just kind of, it's very interesting to think about the logistics of a fake dating romance. Like, I think even there's such a thing as organizing a press photo that looks like you've been kind of shocked yeah. paparazzi, but actually it's obviously planned. Because I think like we've often seen paparazzi photos that are so good or so kind of like perfectly placed that you're like, I think that was planned. I think someone was paid to take that photo, or at least I think they knew the paparazzi was there and deliberately took that shot. And so it was kind of taking that thought and then extending it to the point where you're like, okay, how would the logistics of that actually work? And what would that look like for the person who has to organize it? And also like, what sort of personality would you have if you were the sort of person who has a bunch of paparazzi callers, paparazzi photographers on speed dial? And we came up with quite a sort of mercenary nihilistic character in Marie, the publicist, who was like very abrupt and direct.
One of my favorite characters though. So funny. And you just saying that, I remember when those pictures of J-Lo and Ben Affleck came back out, you know, recreating the iconic pose, and someone being like, this is clearly fake, and I was like, what do you mean people don't do that? Of course they do.
Yeah, but I think those ones, it was so interesting because with that one I was like, yeah, clearly fake, like that's so staged, but do I really care? Like, they're still doing this for my entertainment. It's a great picture. It looks good. Like, I believe the fantasy, whether or not it's real, is kind of not really, doesn't really make a difference to my consumption of the picture, because I'm like, I'm having a great time. They look like they're having a good time.
And also, I mean, I think the other thing is the kind of backstage element. Like, if it's fake, that doesn't mean I'm not super interested in what's going on between the two of them and how they talked about it and how they strategized that fake photograph. Like,
what the moments before and after were like. Like, what do you talk about after you've kind of like touched someone's bum for a fake photo?
Yeah, what are they having for lunch or something? I would love to know, just before we go today, how you found the journey to publication and what it's been like since the book came out.
Yeah, we had a kind of slightly interesting journey in that we didn't have to do the sort of dreaded agent hunt, which I know that a lot of authors, you know, kind of talk about as the period where you're sending out your manuscript and waiting for months and months. So luckily, I published a short story in Catapult magazine, and an agent approached us on the basis of that short story, which is something I would actually really recommend to any aspiring writers, which is, you know, short stories are great practice and yet not as much time commitment for writing a novel, and you never know who's going to read them. So that's always a fun tip. But yeah, after that, it moved pretty smoothly. We were set up with like a really incredible publishing team, Grand Central in the US and Headline Review in the UK and Commonwealth. So we had two amazing editors who we worked really closely with. And then obviously we had the kind of interesting experience of a book coming out during COVID. but I think we were luckier than a lot of debut authors because it was 2021, everybody sort of knew the drill a little bit. So there was, we knew how to do Zoom events, you know, there wasn't this sort of like desperate scramble. We knew people were still reading books. So I feel really lucky. If we had to have a pandemic book, it was, you know, we were in a much better situation than some of the poor people who had to have 2020 debuts.
That's true, yeah. And then I think the main thing about kind of since the book's been published that's been really fun is getting to see people online kind of fangirling over the characters in the same way that we would have imagined within the universe of the book, people fangirling over Leo and Wynne as a couple. I think that's been really fun. Like, we've had people making fake Instagram posts that Leo and Wynne might have posted about each other, which is just like so fun, such a good time. And people making kind of like playlists and videos and things like that. So I think that's always, I think we were always like, our main goal for this book is to have some reader who's just read it go on Twitter and be like, ah, this is so romantic. And like, we've seen that happen. So I think that's kind of like,
mission accomplished. Exactly.
And are you working on your next book together as well?
We are, yeah. We plan to write together probably for the foreseeable. Yeah. So it's probably too early to say much about the next book right now. I will say it's a little bit darker than The View is Exhausting, but it has a massive love story at its core, as I suspect they always will.
Yeah. We're never not able to write a romance. There's always got to be a romance for us to write it, I think.
And that's kind of really romantic in itself. I can see someone writing a book about a couple that write books together.
That's book three.
Okay, I would like some royalties, that would be great. Thank you so much, Michaela and Anjali, for joining us. How can we find and follow you both on social media and get our hands on a copy of this fabulous book?
So we're on Instagram at Mick and Onge, which is MIKANDONJ, and then I'm also on Twitter at Mick Clements. You can find our book in all good bookstores, and yeah,
Yes, on Amazon. I'm also told that the audiobook on Audible is incredible. I think we got a really, really wonderful voice actor to do it, and my mum was very, very impressed. I actually haven't listened to it because it feels a little bit scary if someone else reading your book out loud to you, but I'm told that it's amazing. Yeah, and otherwise it's available everywhere online as well.
Thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. It's also available as a podcast, which you can download from wherever you get yours. Our book club book next month is Claire Fuller's Unsettled Ground, which has just been longlisted for the Costa Prize and was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. You can follow us on Instagram at BTN Book Club or send us an email at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful and restful Christmas, and we'll see you in the new year.